Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
So, how are you reacting to the Dow reaching an all-time high last week? How should you react? Financial planner Kevin McKinley has some advice coming up during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Every Tuesday at this time, Kevin shares information and advice on your money and answers your personal finance questions, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And today, Kevin will also have some tips on saving cold, hard cash with your freezer. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
Have you recovered from springing forward, Kevin, or are you tired and grumpy like I am from losing that hour?
I'm perpetually tired and grumpy, so it really doesn't make any difference. Year-round, daylight savings time, whether I go into that special part of Indiana that doesn't celebrate daylight savings time, whether I go out of that special part of Indiana that does celebrate, I'm always the same, so I'm fine.
Yeah, well, when you're on a schedule like mine, you don't want to lose an hour, but I understand that you have a simple, nearly free solution to helping me feel better in the morning, wake up even earlier, help us spend less and lose weight. A nearly free solution to all those problems. Care to tell us what that is?
I'm going to let the listeners' minds reel collectively for a moment, and then I'm going to reveal that it's a simple glass of tap water. Often forgotten, but we had a discussion in our household recently that discussed the benefits and the virtues of tap water, and we decided to do a little bit more investigation into it, and we came up with this often forgotten vehicle to do all these things, and then we found some scientific studies that prove the value of this simple glass of tap water.
So how does it help us wake up in the morning?
Well, first of all, if you have a glass or two later in the day, and especially before you go to bed, it'll give you a reason to get up in the morning, if you know what I mean. But it will also help you avoid a hangover if you've drank too much and you're being dehydrated. But especially when you wake up, if you're feeling a little groggy and a little cranky, and especially if the time change has really gotten you off your schedule, try drinking a big glass of tap water right away when you wake up. It'll help you get rehydrated and help you feel much better and start the day. And you'll also find you might be even drinking less coffee because you'll feel more energized just from the rehydration of the water rather than trying to get the hydration from the coffee.
Oh, that's my problem. So how does water help me lose weight?
Well, there's several ways. There was a study from Virginia Tech, and they gave adults age 55 to 75 the option of drinking water before meals, and had a control group that did not drink water. And over a 12-week weight loss period, the control group lost about 11 pounds, and the group that drank a glass of water before every single meal lost about 15 and a half pounds, and all the things being equal between the two groups. Obviously, if you're choosing a glass of tap water instead of a caloric beverage such as a soda pop or even milk or juice especially, or a beer, the glass is going to help you lose quite a bit of weight. The water will make a big difference, and you'll feel just as full, and you'll still wash the same food down in the same manner.
Yeah, and if I get a glass of water at the restaurant rather than a soda, that's going to save money, isn't it?
A very big difference. Americans eat out on average about three times per week, and if you figure about $2 or so for the paid-for soda, That averages out to probably about $300 per year per person. And then bottled water as well. We go through billions of gallons of bottled water every single year. If you drink tap water, usually it tastes just as good and it's just as safe as the bottled water you can consume. And there's no disposable plastic to worry about. You'll save yourself a lot of money that way. And then here's a lesser known way that drinking water can help you save money. A woman named Mirjam Tuck, a Netherlands professor, did a study, and she found that people who went shopping with a full bladder, not urgently full, but just were content and drank several glasses of water before they went shopping, actually exercised better behavior control at impulse shopping, meaning that if your bladder is full, you drank some water before you hit the stores, you're less likely to give in to temptation to buy things that you know you'll probably regret purchasing later on.
That's amazing. You know, Kevin, I want to thank you because you told me on the show once, and take credit even if you didn't, to not necessarily order a beverage other than water at a restaurant, because it turns out that that's like half your restaurant tab usually is just that one drink, whatever it is.
Yeah, one of the downsides of that, of course, if you are trying to support the restaurant, most
yes.
restaurateurs will tell you that they basically break even on the food and they make all their profits on the beverage. So if there is a way that you can get some money in their pockets without having to order a beverage, a normal beverage, please do that. But yes, if you're trying to save money while you're eating out, glasses of water are a much better deal than buying a beer, a soda, a pop, or something else.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, if there's a money matter on your mind, call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for the On Your Money email bag, and Jeff in Madison wants to know, with all the talk of selling because the Dow has hit its all-time high, what was the last high that the market surpassed after a major recession, and how much higher did it go? What is different now than the last time it hit and went past the previous all-time high? Well, that's a good question. Do you have a good answer,
yeah,
Kevin?
That's one of the reasons we chose this one, and especially it's in the news a lot because of these highs that the Dow breaks. I mean, keep in mind, people, when you hear news about the Dow Jones Industrial Average or the Standard & Poor's 500 and indices up, down, whatever, keep in mind that these indices were invented by financial news publishing companies. And they were basically to get us to do exactly what we're doing, which is talk about it and go pursue more financial information. So remember that when you're hearing about that. Now, the Dow has broken a new all-time high, and it's kept doing it every day for about the past week and a half or so, up to about 14,300 or so, almost 9 days in a row of up here. But when we're talking about the Dow, not only if it's going up or down, but also as an illustration for what you might want to do with your money, keep in mind that it's usually just good maybe as a guide rather than a specific recommendation or actual advice as to what you might want to do next.
So what's different this time than the last time it hit an all-time high?
Well, let's start with the index itself. It obviously has a different makeup, not just in terms of some of the companies that are in the Dow Jones Industrial Average is 30 different stocks, and those stocks are changed periodically by the Dow Jones Publishing Company. but also the stocks are taking up different portions of the index as well. Also, keep in mind that in those stocks are priced in dollars, and so the inflation can actually affect the index itself. If you put inflation in right now, 14,300 would actually be the equivalent of 13,000 after you adjusted for inflation. And then in terms of economic conditions, the last time the Dow Jones was this high, gas is about a dollar higher per gallon. Unemployment, about two times as many Americans are listed as unemployed right now as well. And then investment conditions are vastly different as well. Interest rates back then were 4.64% on the 10-year Treasury, and they're down about 1.3% on a 10-year Treasury right now, which really buys into what we've talked about before. It echoes that this is really a Federal Reserve-driven rally, meaning the Federal Reserve is printing money to purchase Treasury bonds, which is driving interest rates down, and that's moving money out of things that people would normally prefer to and into things like stocks and real estate and other investment vehicles.
So what happened the last time the index hit this level?
It's typically what you might expect. People buy into a little bit. They say, this has gone up. It's breaking new highs. I'm missing out on this. I got to jump on this train before it leaves the station. And that momentum does help fuel a little bit more momentum in the price of the index and the price of stocks in general. But usually buying in after markets break new highs is a recipe for disaster, and it actually comes fairly quickly. Oftentimes you'll find that after the Dow has broken new highs, 6 to 12 months, people who bought at the high are down 10 to 20% or more. And sometimes it's taken years to get back to that rate again before it breaks another new high. But eventually it always has risen. Usually there will always be a new high broken. It's just a matter of how long it takes to get back there again and what happens to your portfolio in the meantime.
So how should investors react to this milestone then?
Still have you take a step back and ask yourself these questions. If you're adding money to your portfolio by saving through a retirement plan versus withdrawing it for retirement or college expenses or living expenses, if you need growth versus just wanting growth for the purpose of appreciation, and if you won't need this money for at least 5 years or so, and you can handle a 30 to 50% decline that could potentially happen, you're okay investing or staying invested or even starting to invest. But if you say no to any of those questions, you might want to rethink things and just concentrate more on some of the safer alternatives out there rather than trying to, as I mentioned, jump on this train as it's heading out of the station.
I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. If you have a question for Kevin, our number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Arlene in Two Rivers is with us. Hi, Arlene.
Hi, good morning. The reason for my call is I have some IRA on account for my husband and I, as well as an Edvest account for my children. And I virtually do not know nothing about it except for the day that I open them. And I would like to be more involved and know what is going on or what am I looking forward in the future except for me putting money out of my bank account every month. Do you have any suggestions on how I can go about this?
How can she get more informed about her investments, Kevin?
I say just listen to the show, Arlene. It's really 1 hour every Tuesday. That's all you have to do. If you want to listen to the rebroadcast later on, you can. But really, all information that you need about money is contained within these 54 minutes or so. Other than that, Arlene, I would, if you want some kind of consumer-friendly places to go to find out more about your finances, the much maligned USA Today has, they have a money section that goes fairly in-depth on a lot of different topics that affect your finances, but it is written in a way that you feel like it's not talking down to you, but it is at a more basic level than what that's understandable to a lot of people. The Wall Street Journal is probably the next best place to look as well for ongoing information for it, especially if you're looking for actual personal finance stories. One of my favorite sources, Arlene, I'm going to give you two, actually, that I liked. And I even find out things that I didn't know or was needed to be reminded of are in these two sources. One is Kiplinger magazine, and the other one is Consumer Reports Money Advisor. And the Consumer Reports Money Advisor costs about $30 a year. They send you usually about an 8-page newsletter, and there's very little advertising. It's only for their own organization and products. But go to consumerreports.org and check that out. And that's a really good way to find out more about general financial information without having to get too in-depth, and more importantly, without having to be sold something.
Good luck, Arlene, and good for you. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. We'll get to more of your personal finance questions in just a moment. We do have, but somebody will hang up soon, is going to say we have an open line, but somebody rang in. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org.
Greenback paper bill. Yes, just a little piece of paper coated with chlorophyll.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Coming up, we will get some tips on saving cold, hard cash, and also Kevin will have some advice on places to park your non-retirement assets. And now we have room for you and your phone calls at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Mike in Oshkosh is with us next. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. I wonder if the guest could comment on what he thinks will happen to pensions in the future, specifically to municipal, state, county, federal employees. When you look at the obligations that future taxpayers have, by the way, I'm a federal employee, so I've been watching this for, 27 years. And I do support the sequester, by the way, because I understand what's going to happen in the future. But the obligation to our kids and grandkids to actually pay this, frankly, $100 trillion obligated debt when you throw in Medicare, Medicaid, and such, and then you throw the pension obligations, the unfunded pension obligations in the future, you know, frankly, there isn't going to be the money to pay. You know, I'll probably get my pension paid, but, you know, young federal workers and state workers, I just don't know where the money is. When you look at states, they have trillions of dollars of obligations that taxpayers simply won't have the money for. So,
well, Mike, thank you very much. Kevin, is there something government employees should do to prepare for possible pension troubles?
Yeah, I would. And Mike actually does bring up a great point. There's not much an individual can do about the greater situation of money in versus money going out versus future promises. I would say with pensions, don't count on it being there, but be pleasantly surprised if it is there and in the amount that you've been promised. And also save for yourself as well. Most people who are subject to pension retirements also have the options of saving in a government 457 or a 403B plan at work, or even a Roth IRA. And the Roth IRA is a nice deal because it allows you to save for retirement. True, you do not get a tax break on the contributions generally, but you can pull the contributions back out tax-free whenever you want with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And then in retirement, the Roth distributions are tax-free. So if Social Security is there and your pension payment is there, all of those are taxable distributions for you in retirement. The Roth IRA is a nice way to augment that income in retirement without adding to the tax bill. So it allows you to save a little bit on your own without deferring even more for it. But he's exactly right, but there's not much an individual can do about it other than hope for the best and expect the worst and do a little bit on your own of what you can.
Next we go to Barbara in Oshkosh. Hello, Barbara.
Hello. I love your program. I listen to it every Tuesday.
And we love you, and we are happy you called in, Barbara.
Well, my question today is, I'm a grandmother, and I would like to have, I have small grandchildren now, and I would like to put some money away for them for schooling, like college age. Everybody's giving me different advice on where to put my money and how to do it, and I don't know what to do.
Well, you came to the right place, Barbara, and thank you for your kind words. That's a good way to get your call taken on me.
Right.
The One of my favorite investment vehicles for grandparents who want to save for their grandchildren's college education are 529 college savings plans. And Wisconsin's plan is known as the EDVEST plan, E-D-V-E-S-T. You can use just about any state's plan for any child in any other state, but Wisconsin's EDVEST plan does give a small state income tax break on grandparents for grandparents when they make deposits for their grandchildren. The neat thing about it is that you can keep total control over the money. So you can open up an EDVEST account for a specific grandchild, but you are still the owner of the account. You can change that beneficiary whenever you want, or you can even use the money yourself. It works kind of like a Roth IRA for education, if you will. There are different investment options within the 529 plan. My favorite is the age-based. It's based on the age of the child beneficiary, and as the child grows older, the funds invested are invested more conservatively. And the earnings on the account within the 529, while the money is left in there, are sheltered from taxation. Then if the funds are withdrawn and applied for qualified higher education expenses, and that qualification is fairly liberal, there are no taxes on the earnings whatsoever. So it gives you a great opportunity to save for the kids' education without having to actually give them the money, and they only get it if you want to give it to them if you remain the owner of the account.
Okay, that's wonderful. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Barbara. What a nice grandmother. Thank you for calling. Vincent in Lake Bluff, Illinois. Hello, Vincent. Oh, Vincent, you're not listening on the telephone because I just heard the radio. Are long-term disability expenses taxable, is Vincent's question, Kevin.
That's a good question. It depends on how they were paid for by the employer or whatever. We are going to address that in a few weeks, so we'll answer Vincent's question for him at that time.
All right. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Maureen in Mineral Point is with us. Hi, Maureen.
Hi there. I'm starting a new job that does not have a 401k match. And I'm curious if I should use the money I would have put into that and put it in a Roth IRA. And my question is, wouldn't I pay more in taxes now while I'm earning money than I would in retirement? Do you see where I'm going?
You're saying that it'd be better to defer the taxes now and then pay them when you pull it out in retirement. Is that correct?
That's what I'm wondering.
Yep, you are wondering correctly, Maureen, and that will be true for more people. Usually workers are better off deferring taxation by putting money into an at-work plan like a 401k, 403b, 457, or your own self-directed IRA if you don't have an at-work plan that you can use, and deducting the deposit amount from your taxable income. And then later on when you pull it out in retirement, typically most people are in a much lower tax bracket and pay little or nothing on those withdrawals when they're retired.
So the Roth probably isn't the best option for me. Is that correct?
It depends on your situation, because Roths are great for people who have already maxed out their pre-tax savings plans like 401ks and 403bs and put as much in as they can, or people who do not earn very much income right now and don't get taxed very much and probably don't have a ton of savings, so this money that they are thinking about putting aside for retirement is needed and might be needed within a few years. And as I mentioned before, with Roth IRAs, you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want with no taxes or penalties, the contribution portion of the account. So they do make a very effective kind of an ersatz savings account, retirement account. They don't give you a tax break now, but it's tax-free when you retire. However, if you are in a higher tax bracket, now generally above the 15% ceiling, you're probably better off with a pre-tax IRA rather than the Roth IRA.
All right. Good luck, Maureen. Now we go to Bob in Madison. You're on the air, Bob.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question. Stocks versus bonds. Why is it when you're purchasing stocks in any, you always know what a commission is being charged, and with the bonds, you don't know. The bonds are usually sold by these bondholders, or bonds by the face value of the bond. Then why the difference?
That's a good question. It's because the bonds are typically, and this isn't always the case, but bonds are typically sold out of a dealer's inventory. But again, that's not always the case, and often have a markup within the bonds, and that's how the bond desk often makes the money. And it's kind of like you, when you buy any product, or let's say a used car or whatsoever, you're going to pay more than what the dealer paid to bring the car onto the lot to help pay for the dealer's profit, the salesperson's commission, et cetera. But the expenses are more opaque with bonds than they are with stocks and securities. Now, there are some stocks that you do end up paying the same kind of hidden markup, if you will, but it's much less common with that. And it's usually because stocks are more of a commodity. They're fairly easier to price and sell. Bonds are traded usually much less and are also a little bit harder to price and sell and have some risk to be kept on in the inventory as well. So there is some reason for it, but I understand your frustration.
Thank you, Bob, for the call. Judy in Racine is our next caller. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have an Ed Best question also. I'm contributing to an EdVest account for my 2-year-old granddaughter, and it's age-adjusted for risk. Is it possible to lose all that money if things went bad?
I suppose it's possible, Judy. Highly unlikely. It definitely can go down. It can and will go down just with the value in the investments. That's part of the risk you have to accept if you're looking for the greater reward of trying to earn money on the investment as well. But going to zero, put it this way, we would all have much bigger problems than the loss of future education funds if the assets within there were to go straight to zero. I do know that many 529 accounts have a fixed or a stable or a guaranteed option. That's the good news, is you probably can't lose money on that. The bad news is it doesn't pay anything whatsoever. So if all you're trying to do is just hang on to what you have, usually the 529 doesn't offer a whole lot more options beyond that. So it's hard to take advantage of that because, you're quite frankly, your investments won't keep pace with inflation of the price of college.
Makes sense, Judy?
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, it's time now for Smart Assets. And Kevin, I know that you have some insight for investors looking for places to park their non-retirement assets. What should we know about tax breaks for certain gains in income?
Well, Uncle Sam is not just a taker, although how most people are feeling this time of year, that might belie your experience. He also gives some opportunities, and this is generally for money that is outside of IRAs and 401ks and Roth IRAs. Now, if you do need safety, as we've mentioned before, CDs and savings bonds, even with their very low yields, are still the best place for most people. But if you have a desire for longer-term rates of return, you are willing to accept some risk, there are other types of investments out there that can net you more money, even commensurate with the extra risk, and it depends on if you want income or growth or even if you want a combination thereof.
All right, well, let's start with income. What can you tell us about income?
There's a couple different ways that you can invest for income and still get a tax reduction, if you will. The first one is tax-free bonds and more useful, I guess, is tax-free bond mutual funds. Those generally pay the same or higher yield right now than many taxable bond funds, especially than government bond funds. But because the interest generated is generally tax-free, you get to keep much more of what you earn, at least in the case of the interest. These are generally best for people who are in a higher tax bracket, again, above that 15% federal income tax bracket. That figure is delineated on line 43 of the 1040, and it's about $36,000 or so for single filers and $72,000 or so for married couples filing jointly. If that number is higher than that, you might want to look at tax-free funds. Keep in mind that that as we've just were talking about, tax-free bonds, there are less of them than government bonds. They generally trade more on a more volatile basis, and there are other risks in there. For instance, the ability for the underlying municipality to actually pay the interest and pay to have the bonds redeemed. So there are going to be some risks along with a chance for greater reward.
Yes. So what about investors looking for growth?
I think we get probably at least a half a dozen calls a week here on people saying that this guy or this woman is trying to get me to buy an annuity, saying that I can get growth, and because it remains in the annuity, it's tax advantage. That's true, but the problem is when you pull it out, it's taxed as ordinary income, which is going to be taxed at your higher rate. You might be better off looking at tax-managed mutual funds that can invest in a variety of stocks and bonds and other securities, but the managers or the systems consciously try to control the taxable distributions. And so if you do get interest, it's not very much. And if you do get capital gains, they're typically the long-term variety. Now, that means you'll have a built-up capital gain there, so it could be more when you sell. But definitely the long-term gains get treated much better than short-term gains and are still taxed at a much lower rate.
What if you want to combine a way to get income and growth?
If you're willing to accept some risk and again, lots of volatility, individual stocks or stock mutual funds offer some great tax benefits to people in that category. The tax laws that were recently passed kept long-term gains, capital gains rates at 0% for people in the 25% and under bracket. And even then, it's only 15% if you're over that. Unless you're in the 1% of Americans, then you pay 20% tax on your long-term capital gains. And dividend income, qualified dividend income, gets treated the same way. So you might find yourself not only making some money, even realizing capital gains, and collecting dividend income and not paying any taxes on it whatsoever. So again, this is best for people who have a long-term outlook, who can handle volatile moves in their portfolio, and more importantly, need this growth rather than just want it.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. And this is On Your Money. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Bob in Holman is with us now. Hello, Bob.
Hi, I have a question. My employer offers both a regular 401k and a Roth 401k savings plan for retirement, and I'm one of the lucky people who, I guess, I have a higher income now than I think I will have in retirement. I'm currently investing in the Roth 401k because I've spent a lot of years investing in a regular 401k, and I kind of wanted to have a little bit of both upon retirement. I just wanted to see if I'm thinking and doing the right thing or if I should still stick with the traditional 401k to defer tax now.
Unless, Bob, unless you are going to be getting probably $50,000 in income in retirement if you're single, and $100,000 if you're married filing jointly, you are probably going to be in a lower tax bracket when you are retired. And therefore, I get the idea of diversifying your tax options, if you will, in retirement. I'd still prefer that you max out the pre-tax contribution, the 401k, the regular 401k, 403b, and 457, rather than the Roth 401k. And then if you have more money and you qualify, make an individual Roth IRA contribution. And if you're married, you can do that for your spouse as well, even if he or she doesn't have a job or an income. But that's usually a better bet rather than using the Roth 401k, because it's likely that your tax rate will be lower, but it's still, there's a decent chance that taxes could come back to hit the middle class harder than in the future than they do right now. So I'd rather have you still defer what you have today, but then use the Roth IRA on top of that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Bob. Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, with us every Tuesday with information and advice on your money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
My mama told me, you better shop around. Oh, yeah, you better shop around.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. And March is Frozen Foods Month. Bet you didn't know that. We thought we would spend some time discussing one of our favorite money-saving investments, and that's frozen foods. Kevin, why are frozen foods the way to go? Hello, Kevin. Are you there?
Yes, there. I was just restocking the freezer. I'm back now. It's one of our favorite ways to use your ingenuity and a little bit of pre-advance planning to buy items that are on sale and either store them or use them to prepare them in bulk and then freeze them. You not only save time preparing each individual meal, but you save a ton of money and you can eat healthier because you get a better self-prepared meal right at your disposal that can be popped into the microwave and you don't have to go to the counter or the drive-thru or belly up to the bar to get something to eat.
How much of a freezer's savings are eaten up by the increased energy use?
Eaten up. I like that.
That's a good one.
It generally costs about 50 cents a day to operate a freezer chest, if you will. If you buy an energy-efficient model, it might be a little less than that. If you use an old one right now, especially one that's been bought more than 10 or 20 years ago, you might want to actually look at replacing it because they cost about $200 to $300, and the old ones are so inefficient that you might actually make up that savings within the first year or so and then save not only energy but money every day after that. And there's actually a really neat calculator online that we'll put up at onyourmoney.com that you can calculate based on your particular area's energy cost what an upright freezer might cost you to run.
Yeah, so what's the best way to start filling it? What do you advise?
Start with a plan. Know before you go into the store what you're going to be looking for, but then stay flexible. And especially when you're picking up any kind of meat product whatsoever, if you find something on sale, that's the thing that you want to buy, and then you want to freeze it as soon as possible. Keep in mind, too, if you're going through, you start in the produce aisle, and you're looking at all this great fresh produce, fantastic, and that's where I usually load up most of my food in the cart. The problem is that stuff tends to go bad fairly quickly, and it can be very expensive based on the weight. Frozen vegetables are generally just as healthy for you as the fresh variety, but they often cost about 20 to 30 cents on the dollar for their compared to the fresh version or so. So buy anything that needs to be frozen last, and then go home as soon as possible and start working on it, and you better use it and freeze it. Make sure you have some time once you get home from the supermarket to freeze all this stuff or prepare it so you can get it in the freezer right away.
How long generally can we keep items frozen before they're not so good anymore?
Well, the FDA says that actually if they're frozen properly and handled properly, it's almost indefinitely. It's usually more of a quality issue. If you want, you can get freezer burn on these things. It might affect the look of it. It might affect the taste a little bit. But usually meat typically is okay for anywhere from 1 month for hot dogs up to a year or more for a whole turkey or a chicken. Vegetables, again, often indefinitely or so, especially if they never melt and refreeze again. Prepackaged items, you're usually looking at a couple years for that as well. But also, you definitely want to know what you have in your freezer, and you want to use it as quickly as possible to get the best optimal output on your cooking.
Yeah, so do you keep track of what's in your freezer? Do you go through some sort of program, labeling program?
Yeah, it's pretty neat. I got an idea here where someone I know attached a whiteboard directly to the top of the lid of the freezer, and they have everything kind of laid out in a blueprint of where everything is in the freezer, all the different categories for it. And then they date the bags of every single different item as well, so they know where it is. And that does a couple of things. First of all, it allows you to know right away what you do have in the freezer, what you might need to replace. You can organize it by the section of the freezer. And then you get to look at it without opening it and letting valuable energy and cold air out. And also not incurring the problem of having to refreeze it if you open the door, you leave it open, search it around, a lot of warm air gets in, and then you have to shut it again. That can cause a lot of problems with the food.
That sounds good. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, our number is 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Alan in Salem. Hello, Alan.
Hi there.
What's your question?
I recently consolidated some student loan debt about 5 years ago now. It's about $50,000 at 10%. And from what I understand, there's really no options out there for a consolidated private loan. Do I have any options to lower that interest rate or reduce my payment or anyone to help me out?
Great question, Alan. Sorry about your situation, and you're right. There are very few options available to people who do have private loans outstanding. Have you contacted the lender yet?
I have not directly, no.
Okay, that would be the first step. And understand that the lender, obviously, they want to get their money back. They want to get as much from you as they possibly and legally can. But they also understand that there are only some things that can be done. And so often you will find that private lenders, in some cases, are willing to work with people to develop a payment plan that you can afford, but it's very difficult to get out from under them, especially on a private lender basis. So I would contact them. And then we also have a guide that we found. I'll have to research the link for you, but there is a guide to dealing with them from a nonprofit that helps people negotiate student loan debt and deal with overhanging debt. We'll put that up at onyourmoney.com later on today for you.
Thank you.
All right. Good luck to you, Alan. Thanks for the call. Our next caller is Walt in West Bend. Hello, Walt.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
My question for Kevin is, I have an investment in a privately held company, a private issue, and I'm wondering if there is a way that I can convert that investment into a Roth investment.
So is it your own company, Walt, or is it just one that you happen to have?
No, it isn't my own company.
Okay. It's difficult to do for several reasons, one of which is you can only make a contribution. There's a limit to amount of money you can put into a Roth at, $5,000 to $6,000 a year or so, depending on your age, and that got bumped up for 2013. But so that you can't just go out and say, well, I'm going to slide the value of this company into my Roth IRA as a contribution. You have to put cash into it, and then you have to use the Roth IRA to actually purchase the shares back again. The bigger problem is finding a custodian of Roth IRAs who will allow you to do that, and the bookkeeping on it can be very difficult. Now, it's been done. I've seen it done and some case studies on it. It's extremely difficult to do, and generally, unless you're wildly profitable with the company, it's not worth the effort to do it, in part because there are losses that you can take by investing in a private company, that expenses or losses on the investment, that once it's in the Roth IRA, it's very difficult to deduct that loss if that happens for you down the road. So unless it's an extraordinary situation, it's probably not worth it, but it can be done. You just have to find a private custodian who will be willing to do that. If you search on the web Google private custodian Roth IRA, you might be able to find some people who are willing to do it. But again, it's going to be very expensive and time-consuming.
Okay. This private company apparently is revalued every year. Who requires that reevaluation? Is this federal government or private issues?
That much I don't know. I don't know who or why they would willing to do that. It might be just for the shareholders. It might be for for you, so that you can know actually what the valuation is of your investment. It might be part of the contingency of under which you put your money into it.
Good luck to you, Walt. Thanks for the call. If you have a question, a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, we now do have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And our next caller is Barb in Madison. Hi, Barb.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question. My husband has been at two or three jobs and has different pools of money in different accounts, M&I and different investment 401Ks, or 403Bs really for him, and I believe. Anyway, at this point, he's in a job where they won't match until he's there for a year, and they don't pay as well as the other jobs, so he might be looking for another. In the meantime, rather than starting a whole new separate investment, being whatever they offer, would it make sense to put that money aside in a Roth IRA and then when he's in a place that he feels really settled in, then can you transfer that money into that investment vehicle, if that makes any sense?
It made sense to me.
Okay.
It made sense to you.
Not that it you should do it, but I understood what you're asking.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Barb, I think that that's a good, it's a well intended question. I would be cautious of doing it simply because I don't think it's going to be possible for most employers to bring IRA money into the 401k. I think you should do it, but I think you should do it under the notion that you are probably, if you open up an IRA or a Roth IRA for that matter, you're going to have one more account. But usually that's not a reason to do it. What I'd actually do is take all the other accounts that that you and he have accumulated in these different accounts and roll them into one self-directed IRA, and you can do that at a bank or a credit union or a mutual fund company or a place like Vanguard or Fidelity or Schwab or all kinds of different places. But they'll do the consolidation for you, so it is in just one IRA. And then he can make contributions to that are tax deductible now. And then when he is ready to go to a place that does have a plan or he does qualify to make at-work contributions, if you have to, you can stop making contributions to the IRA and start making contributions to the 401k or 403b.
Okay, so that's not a Roth, that's a regular IRA.
That's right, and you can open a Roth IRA too if you want. But if you're going to be in a lower income situation, the Roth IRA might be better for you. If you're in a higher income and you want the tax break, the tax deductible IRA is probably a better way to go.
Good luck to you, Barb, and thanks for the call. Let's take one more call, Josh in Portage. Hi, Josh.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question would be, can you explain the benefits, if any, of taking out a indexed universal life insurance policy that accrues cash value at a fairly rapid rate? Because I believe they have a minimum, if you get an indexed universal life, they have a minimum rate of return of 6% versus paying tax on your money after you withdraw on a traditional IRA. But even with the Roth IRA, where you pay taxes now and not upon drawing upon retirement, because the as far as I'm understanding is the indexed universal life policies, when you you pay taxes now, when you contribute, you pay $200 or $300 a month for that policy. When you draw upon retirement with that cash value available, that cash value that you withdraw is not taxable either. So are there advantages of that versus the IRAs that are performing fairly poorly?
Yeah, Josh, I'm guessing the advantages are mostly to the person who is trying to sell this. Someone is probably trying to get you to do this, right?
Yeah, I know there's these policies available out there, and the projections look pretty attractive.
That's the attractive projections are the biggest reason to be wary of this. There's no place out there right now where an insurance company can earn a guaranteed rate, net rate of return of 6% after all of the commissions that they pay to their salespeople, which, that's how those people get paid, but also the cost of running the insurance company, maintaining reserves, paying for the nice calendars, sponsoring golf tournaments, all those costs. There's no way that they can guarantee you a 6% rate of return. The salesperson might have used that figure as an illustration of how that worked, but if you ask him or her to show you where is this guaranteed rock solid that come heck or high water, I'm going to get 6% return on that, they won't be able to do it. And then all of a sudden, if you don't earn 6% on it, ask them to say, well, tell you what, just out of curiosity, what if I earn 2% on this? Then what happens? And you'll see that the projections all of a sudden become much less attractive. I'd much rather have you use life insurance for its basic purpose, and that's to cover the loss of income for somebody if they pass away, for someone who's relying on your income. Otherwise, for investment purposes, you're better off saving for retirement through those at-work plans and Roth IRAs that we've discussed. And I would, based on the limited amount of information, I would be very hesitant to recommend the index universal life policy that you've described.
Yeah. Good luck to you, Josh. You know, I wish we had more time. We have a great email. Maybe we can save it for next week. What's the website of the week, Kevin?
NoIdentity.com. NoIdentity.com has a bunch of really great financial and money planning and tracking apps for your iPod, your iPhone, or your iPad, and they're only a couple bucks. NoIdentity.com, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, OnYourMoney.com, later on today.
A preview of the email that I'm going to try to save for next week from Chris in Waterford. He says, I love your show. You are possibly the smartest financial advisor I have ever heard on Tuesday mornings from 8 to 9 a.m. on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Top five, at least. For sure the top five.
All right, so that's the tease. We'll share the email next week. And Kevin, we will see you next week. I know you're going to be in Madison because you're going to be in town for a Wisconsin Public Radio listener event. Look forward to seeing you next week. And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money LLC. Here with us just about every Tuesday for On Your Money. Tomorrow at this time, I'll talk with a guest psychologist and author who says making students sit still and take tests makes them bored and misbehave. He'll make the case for encouraging play to improve the quality of their lives and their education. That's tomorrow at this time. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster and Bill Martins for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.